This is the Internet Multicasting Service. Harper Audio presents the fourth and final section of Ernest Hemingway's The Snows of Kilimanjaro, read by Charlton Heston. The story's conclusion brings a grim resolution to a writer's regrets about his unused talent.
About the half-wit chore boy who was left at the ranch that time and told not to let anyone get any hay. And that old bastard from the Forks who'd beaten the boy when he'd worked for him, stopping to get some feed. The boy refusing and the old man saying he'd beat him again, the boy got the rifle from the kitchen and shot him when he tried to come into the barn. And when they came back to the ranch, he'd been dead a week, frozen in the corral, and the dogs had eaten part of him. But what was left, you packed on a sled, wrapped in a blanket and roped on, and you got the boy to help you haul it. And the two of you took it out over the road on skis and 60 miles down to town to turn the boy over, he having no idea he would be arrested. Thinking he'd done his duty and that you were his friend and he would be rewarded. He'd helped to haul the old man in so everyone could know how bad the old man had been and how he'd tried to steal some feed that didn't belong to him. And when the sheriff put the handcuffs on the boy, he couldn't believe it. Then he started to cry. That was one story he'd saved to write. He knew at least 20 good stories from out there, and he'd never written one. Why? You tell them why, he said. Why what, dear? Why nothing. She didn't drink so much now since she had him. But if he lived, he would never write about her. He knew that now. Nor about any of them. The rich were dull, and they drank too much, or they played too much backgammon. They were dull, and they were repetitious. He remembered poor Julian and his romantic awe of them and how he started a story once that began, "The very rich are different from you and me," and how someone had said to Julian, "Yes, they have more money." But that was not humorous to Julian. He thought they were a special, glamorous race, and when he found they weren't, it wrecked him just as much as any other thing that wrecked him. He'd been contemptuous of those who wrecked. You didn't have to like it because you understood it. He could beat anything, he thought, because nothing could hurt him if he didn't care. All right. Now he would not care for death. One thing he'd always dreaded was the pain. He could stand pain as well as any man until it went on too long and wore him out, but here he had something that had hurt him frightfully, and just when he'd felt it breaking him, the pain had stopped. He remembered long ago when Williamson, the bombing officer, had been hit by a stick bomb someone in a German patrol had thrown as he was coming in through the wire that night, and screaming and begged everyone to kill him. He was a fat man, very brave and a good officer, although addicted to fantastic shows. But that night he was caught in the wire with a flare lighting him up and his bowels spilled out into the wire, so when they brought him in alive, they had to cut him loose.
Shoot me, Harry, for Christ's sake, shoot me.
They'd had an argument one time about our Lord never sending you anything you couldn't bear, and someone's theory had been that meant that at a certain time the pain passed you out automatically. But he'd always remembered Williamson that night. Nothing passed out Williamson until he gave him all his morphine tablets that he'd always saved to use himself. And then they didn't work right away.
Still, this now that he had was very easy. And if it was no worse as it went on, there was nothing to worry about. Except that he would rather be in better company. He thought a little about the company that he would like to have.
No, he thought. When everything you do too long and do too late, you can't expect to find the people still there. The people all are gone. The party's over. And you are with your hostess now. I'm getting as bored with dying as with everything else, he thought. It's a bore, he said out loud.
What is, my dear?
Anything you do too bloody long. He looked at her face between him and the fire. She was leaning back in the chair, and the firelight shone on her pleasantly lined face, and he could see that she was sleepy. He heard the hyena make a noise just outside the range of the fire. I've been writing, he said, but I got tired. Do you think you'll be able to sleep?
Pretty sure. Why don't you turn in?
I'd like to sit here with you.
Do you feel anything strange, she asked him.
No, just a little sleepy.
I do, he said. He just felt death come by again. You know, the only thing I've never lost is curiosity, he said to her. You've never lost anything. You're the most complete man I've ever known.
Christ, he said.
How little a woman knows. What is that, your intuition? Because just then Death had come and rested its head in the foot of the cot, and he could smell its breath. Never believe any of that about a scythe in a skull, he told her. It can be two bicycle policemen as easily. Or be a bird, or it can have a wide snout like a hyena. It had moved up on him now, but it had no shape anymore. It simply occupied space. Tell it to go away. It didn't go away, but moved a little closer. You've got a hell of a breath, he told it. You stinking bastard. It moved up closer to him still, and now he couldn't speak to it. And when it saw he couldn't speak, it came a little closer. And now he tried to send it away without speaking, but it moved in on him so its weight was all on his chest. And while it crouched there and he couldn't move or speak, he heard the woman say, Juana's asleep now. Take the cot up very gently and carry it into the tent. He couldn't speak to tell her to make it go away, and it crouched now heavier so that he couldn't breathe. And then, while they lifted the cot, suddenly it was all right, and the weight went from his chest. It was morning, and had been morning for some time, and he heard the plane. It showed very tiny and then made a wide circle, and the boys ran out and lit the fires using kerosene and piled on grass so there were two big smudges at each end of the level place, and the morning breeze blew them toward the camp, and the plane circled twice more, low this time, and then glided down and leveled off and landed smoothly, and coming walking toward him was old Compton, in slacks, a tweed jacket, and a brown felt hat. What's the matter, old cock? Compton said. Bad leg, he told him. Will you have some breakfast? Thanks, I'll just have some tea. It's the push moth, you know. I won't be able to take the mem sahib. There's only room for one. Your lorry's on the way. Helen had taken Compton aside and was speaking to him. Compton came back more cheery than ever. We'll get you right in, he said. I'll be back for the mem. I'm afraid I'll have to stop at Arusha to refuel. We'd better get going. What about the tea? I don't really care about it, you know. The boys had picked up the cot and carried it around the green tents and down along the rock and out onto the plain and along past the smudges that were burning brightly now, the grass all consumed, and the wind fanning the fire to the little plain. It was difficult getting him in, but once in, he lay back in the leather seat, and the leg was stuck straight out to one side of the seat where Compton sat. Compton started the motor and got in. He waved to Helen and to the boys, and as the clatter moved into the old familiar roar, they swung around with Compy watching for warthog holes and roared, bumping along the stretch between the fires, and with a last bump rose, and he saw them all standing below, waving, and the camp beside the hill flattening now, and the plain spreading, clumps of trees and the bush flattening, while the game trails ran now smoothly to the dry water holes. And there was a new water that he'd never known of. The zebra, small rounded backs now, and the wildebeest, big-headed dots seeming to climb as they moved in long fingers across the plain, now scattering as the shadow came toward them. They were tiny now, and the movement had no gallop, and the plain, as far as you could see, gray-yellow now, and ahead old Compy's tweed back and the brown felt hat. Then they were over the first hills, and the wildebeest were trailing up them. And then they were over mountains with sudden depths of green rising forest and the solid bamboo slopes. And then the heavy forest again, sculptured into peaks and hollows until they crossed. And hills sloped down, and then another plain, hot now, and purple-brown, bumpy with heat, and Compy looking back to see how he was riding. Then there were other mountains, dark ahead. And then, instead of going on to Arusha, they turned left. He evidently figured that they had the gas, and looking down, he saw a pink sifting cloud moving over the ground and in the air, like the first snow in a blizzard that comes from nowhere, and he knew the locusts were coming up from the south. Then they began to climb, and they were going to the east, it seemed, and then it darkened, and they were in a storm, the rain so thick it seemed like flying through a waterfall. And then they were out, and Compy turned his head and grinned and pointed. And there ahead, all he could see, as wide as all the world, great, high, and unbelievably white in the sun, was the square top of Kilimanjaro. And then he knew that there was where he was going. Just then, the hyena stopped whimpering in the night and started to make a strange, human, almost crying sound. The woman heard it and stirred uneasily. She didn't wake. In her dream, she was at the house on Long Island, and it was the night before her daughter's debut. Somehow her father was there, and he'd been very rude. Then the noise the hyena made was so loud she woke, and for a moment she didn't know where she was, and she was very afraid.
Then she took the flashlight and shone it on the other cot that they'd carried in after Harry'd gone to sleep. She could see his bulk under the mosquito bar, but somehow he'd gotten his leg out and it hung down alongside the cot. The dressings had all come down and she couldn't look at it. Molo, she called. Molo, Molo. Then she said, Harry, Harry. Then her voice rising, Harry, please. Oh, Harry. There was no answer and she couldn't hear him breathing. Outside the tent, the hyena made the same strange noise that had awakened her. But she did not hear him for the beating of her heart.
This has been Harper Audio. HarperCollins is the copyright owner of this recording and has consented to a limited distribution of Harper Audio as an 8 kHz computer sound file on Internet Town Hall. It is a violation of United States and international copyright laws to copy these recordings in any other way. Harper Audio is a trademark of HarperCollins Publishers, Inc. To order a copy of this tape or to request a catalog of all Harper Audio spoken word cassettes, please call 1-800-C-HARPER or 717-941-1214 or send mail to harper@town.hall.org. This has been a production of the Internet Multicasting Service. Support for Harper Audio is provided by HarperCollins and by Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Network connectivity for the Internet Multicasting Service is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet.